listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This past week, the city-state of Singapore played host to the 33rd summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN. Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong opened the meetings with a warning against the rise of protectionism. Miro Liu filed this report from Singapore for China's global television network, CGTN.
During his opening address, PM Lee praised ASEAN's efforts while stressing on the need for multilateral cooperation and pooling of resources to tackle key issues troubling the region.
I'm glad that during our term as chairman, member countries have redoubled our integration efforts and come up with concrete measures that lay the groundwork for a united, effective, and relevant ASEAN.
Earlier in the day, the Chinese premier addressed the 44th Singapore lecture, where he touched upon several key issues like relations between China and Singapore, free trade, and the South China Sea. Premier Lee stressed on the need for free and fair trade and mentioned that China will adhere to multilateralism and to resolving issues through dialogue.
I have said on several occasions that China has all along supported and upheld free trade. At the same time, China believes there should be both free and fair trade. Free trade is the prerequisite because no trade would be possible without a free environment, and no fair trade would be possible either. At the same time, trade that is not fair would not be sustainable.
On the issue of South China Sea, Premier Li shared that China is working with other countries on a code of conduct, which will be finished within the next 3 years. Lee also expressed his wish to strengthen bilateral ties with Singapore and the ASEAN nations. Experts believe that Lee will take his message of cooperation forward when he meets his ASEAN counterparts later this week. Miro Lu, CGTN, Singapore.
Among the world leaders in attendance was Russia's President Vladimir Putin, who held a press conference on Thursday.
What meetings were the most important? Which ones would you highlight? Would the new economic sanctions coming from the West somehow impede our cooperation with the Asia-Pacific countries? Any politically motivated restrictions that trespass into the economic area do indeed pose threat for the economy. They, of course, are an obstacle for ourselves and for our partners and for those who impose the sanctions themselves. But nothing like that can stop our development, our progress, our economic and technological progress. That is why we're going to have to, we will continue cooperation. About 25% of our trade turnover is accounted by Asian states. Last year, the growth was 27%. Over $200 billion. Trade is on the rise in all the areas, in high-tech solutions. For example, smart cities, the idea created by Singapore. And this is this has to do with high technologies. We have signed an agreement on free trade with Vietnam, with India. We have also had talks with Singapore. So, historically, we've had good relations with countries of the region, and nothing can stop us in this respect. And I have no doubts that the prospects are very good. What kinds of meetings were the most important? Well, there were lots of meetings. I met almost all of my counterparts. With, for example, I met with Prime Minister of Japan and Premier of the State Council of China. Today I met Prime Minister of Singapore and Prime Minister of Korea. I just had a small conversation with the President of the U.S. as well. I think I have talked to almost all of the participants of the summit.
Igor Zhdanov, Russia Today.
Mr. President, you have made a long way to come here to Singapore. You met, as you say, almost everyone, all kinds of countries with very varying geopolitical interests. How would you yourself characterize the results of the work here? You know, I spoke about that in my speech today. What characterizes this region of the world is, well, it was... First, we were here in 2005, invited by Malaysia. Then Russia was here as a guest. And even at that time, there was a certain order being formed here in terms of relations between the countries. And it had nothing to do with the processes of globalization. And it had nothing to do with military blocs. At this forum, we see the promotion of the idea of unity and interconnectivity, not as part of military unions. There were no signs of globalism here, because sometimes they are profitable to some, sometimes they are not. This is not something we look towards. Our relations here are based on a more wide basis. And each country chooses its own way of further development. And we now see that this way, this path is very viable. Meetings in such a format are very beneficial to all of us. Good afternoon, Pavel Zarubin, Russia Channel. Yesterday you met Prime Minister of Japan, and Japanese media wrote about the desire of Japan to go back to 1956 declaration, and there were some talks about this declaration. Can you tell us about that? Well, we continued our dialogue with our Japanese counterparts on the basis of the declaration signed in 1956. This was something our Japanese counterparts asked. I have said that on numerous occasions, and I'm going to say that again. After the end of World War II, there was a number of agreements signed on the territory, on government, on state borders. All these agreements are signed as intergovernmental, international documents. We believe there are no problems here. Everything that we see is based on international documents signed during the efforts after World War II. But as you know, Japan poses this issue in a different manner. In 1956, Japan and the USSR signed a declaration, which was called 1956 Declaration, just like that. What does it talk about? It says that the Soviet Union, after signing a peace treaty with Japan, is ready to give two southern islands to Japan. It doesn't say whose sovereignty is going to be on these islands, what kind of basis would be for this transfer of these islands. But the declaration stated this readiness of the USSR to transfer the islands to Japan. Later, both the Council of the USSR and Japan agreed that this was the way forward, but then all changed. During Gorbachev's times, the USSR decided not to go through with this declaration. Then the Japanese asked us to go back to discussing this issue as part of this declaration, but during our discussions,
центр тяжести сместился.
You know, the
отошел уже, по сути дела, от этой декларации 56 года.
The center of gravity changed, so to speak. We moved away from the 1956 declaration, and today, during our meeting with Mr. Abe, he said that Japan would be ready to go back to discussing this issue on the basis of the 1956 declaration, but this would require additional work. Because, as you know, in the declaration itself, not all the details are quite clear. It only outlines the basics of the problem and the basics of the USSR's readiness to transfer the islands. But there are no details about the sovereignty, about the basis for this transferring of the islands, and so on and so forth. It requires additional deliberation and work. Please go on. Andrei Blashkevich, TASS News Agency. My question is about the Davos Forum. How do you treat the idea that Russia could withdraw its participation in the forum unless Russian businessmen are allowed to participate? And if Russia is not present, will it somehow affect Russia's authority in the world economy? No, it will not in any way affect our standing in the global economy, because the standing primarily depends on the economic power of the country itself, on the structure of its economy, on the results achieved by the economy, demonstrated by its new technologies, by its GDP, macroeconomic indicators, a low level of inflation, a low level of debt, a lack of a budget deficit, and of course, best thing to have is to have no budget deficit at all, to have a budget surplus, and we are quite confident in that respect. But Platforms like Davos are very important, and when I was governor of St. Petersburg, I used to go to Davos all the time. Then, when I started working in Moscow, I came there more rarely. I haven't been there for quite some time, but this is a very important and beneficial platform, and the goal of platforms like that is to have discussions, open and free discussion, and it unites people. Regardless of any political restrictions that exist between them, if somebody imposes restrictions within such a platform, they are actually undermining the very idea of the platform. As for our participation in Davos, every person has a right, every businessman or company has a right to be represented there, but our people are free and it is up to them whether they want to come there or not. Thank you.
Егор Сатаев-Гурев, газета «Известия».
There were elections held in Donbass republics, and the and Kyiv authorities said that this went against the Minsk agreements. There haven't been contacts between you and the Ukrainian president for a long time. Why is this happening? Is Russia waiting for a change of powers in Ukraine? There are going to be elections there soon. Well, as for the condemnation of these elections in Donbass republics, first of all, let's say that let's acknowledge that nobody is condemning the killings, the murders that are going on there, politically motivated murders. And what were the people organizing, the people behind this crime thinking? Of course, the elections were inevitable. Secondly, meetings in the Normandy format just prior to the Ukrainian elections makes really no sense. And as we have seen, the current Kyiv authorities are not at all interested in implementing the Minsk agreements. For example, the special status of Donbass, the decision was not agreed on by the Kyiv parliament. This was a key decision, but they don't want to go follow through with it. I think they are still awaiting for us to do something about the Minsk agreement, but we are actually implementing the Minsk agreements, and they're not seeing that they are not doing their part. Now, finally, is Russia able to do anything to achieve a peaceful resolution there? I don't think that we can. Until something changes in Kyiv, we are unable to do anything in these territories. Still, we believe there's no other way forward. We'll have to agree on that somehow. And I hope that people that will lead the country in the future, whoever comes to power in Ukraine, we will respect the choice of the Ukrainian nation. We will work with whomever comes to power in Kyiv. But we still believe that there is no other way forward other than a peaceful way. Right now, in Moscow, in the president's administration, there are picketing about the exchange of prisoners of wars. Have there been any decisions? Well, they wanted to exchange all the prisoners on one side and all the prisoners from other side. But unfortunately, the Ukrainian authorities are saying that some of the people still held in Ukrainian prisons without any trial, they are announced as criminals. They are prosecuted. And they are basically driven outside this framework of prisoner of war exchange. The representatives of Donbass do not agree with that, because they can do the same and also make some of the people change their status, and so they are no longer prisoners of war, so to speak, and they are no longer exchangeable. So, we see that Kyiv has no desire to exchange these prisoners, and we can see the same in the fact that Ukraine is arresting people in the Azov Sea. For example, they just arrested the seamen there. They can, these sailors can fish wherever they want, but they arrested them. This was against the law. They arrested them and kept them for a whole year. This is completely illegal and lawful. And when our border patrol arrested a vessel, a Ukrainian vessel, there was no desire from the Ukrainian authorities to even talk about that. Now you can see how they treat their own citizens. Dmitry Smirnov, Komsomolskaya Pravda. There is a lot of talk about digitization and high-tech, but we can see that Moscow is even more high-tech in several respects than Singapore. Were you impressed by something in Singapore in terms of high-tech? Well, I wouldn't say that we are the best in this respect. Singapore is a great example of a high-tech, smart city. A lot of issues are being resolved here, a lot of societal problems related to housing and so on and so forth. We need to use the same ideas and implant them in Russia. But as for digitization, digital management, and so on and so forth, of course, Moscow was one of the leading capitals in the world. Interfax. Mr. President, you said you had a small conversation with Mr. Mike Pence. What were the results of this conversation? So what about the meeting, possible meeting with Mr. Trump? Another question is about the second wave of sanctions with regard to the Skripal case. Could this somehow affect the preparations for your upcoming summit with Mr. Trump in Buenos Aires? Well, any hostile steps affect in some way the future of our meetings. But we were ready to meet in Paris, but as we've said, we didn't want to interfere with the schedule of this very grand event organized by the French authorities, by the French president. This was a really important, huge meeting attended by over 100 leaders of state. It was very difficult to organize a full-scale work there. That is why we agreed to meet in Buenos Aires, and Vice President Pence said that U.S. is also preparing for this meeting, for the upcoming meeting. We have a lot to discuss with Mr. Trump. And during the working lunch in Paris, we discussed only the very general issues, but very intensive. We were able to participate in this discussion together with Mr. Trump. We talked about security, about the economy, about regional problems. We talked about the same thing with Mr. Pence. One of the key issues is, of course, the issue of strategic stability, strategic security. We need to understand what's happening with the INF treaty, what's going to happen with the new START treaty, how we are going to move forward with this in these areas. We also had other issues to discuss related to our economic relations. We don't have a lot of trade between our two countries, but some of the areas are very promising, and both Russia and the U.S. are interested in that. And finally, the hotspots, the hotbeds throughout the world, the hot issues, so to speak, the Iranian nuclear program, the North Korean nuclear issue. All of these issues are something that both Russia and the U.S. are involved in, and we need to have dialogues on the expert level to resolve this issue, and we are ready to restore full format talks on these issues. Let's have a couple more questions. Глеб Иванов, Arguments and Facts. In Paris, you spoke to Mr. Macron, and one of the issues you discussed was the restoration of Syria, rebuilding of Syria. How is Russia? Is Russia ready to invest money into this rebuilding? It's not just about investing money. We are ready to launch full-scale work in the sectors of the Syrian economy that would be profitable both to us and to the Syrian state and the Syrian people. As part of our joint work, we'll be able to create new jobs in Syria, to restore infrastructure in Syria. There are a lot of things to do in Syria, trust me. And it's not just about direct investments. As for the humanitarian component, we are constantly providing humanitarian aid to Syria. And I believe that our European partners are very understanding in that respect. They are ready as well to cooperate with us along these humanitarian lines. We've talked about that even in Istanbul earlier. When I talked about the provision of various medical aid, and Mr. Macron and others were very understanding, and I hope that this work will continue. Some of the operations have already been concluded together with France. We delivered humanitarian aid to Syria using our and French aircrafts, and I hope that this work will continue, aided by all the countries interested in restoring Syria, because only by restoring the country will we be able to provide people with an opportunity to return to their homes, to provide refugees with the future. And of course, refugees can only return to their homes if they want to. Nobody is going to force them to move out of Jordan, out of Lebanon, to go back to their homes. But if we create the basic conditions, basic infrastructure, electricity, and so on and so forth, if we restore all that, they will return by themselves. All we need to do is get rid of all these phobias we have and get rid of the political problems, political challenges we face, and just help the people. Mr. President, you just said that it makes no sense right now to meet in the Normandy format. So what you're saying is that so long as Mr. Poroshenko is in power, the Normandy 4 will not meet and will not do anything, right? Well, the current president of Ukraine is not interested, as we can see, in implementing the Minsk agreement. The Verkhovna Rada of Ukraine has agreed to make the Donbass region to change its status, but Mr. Poroshenko did not sign the law. Maybe if the powers in Ukraine change, maybe the newcomers will change the situation. I don't know if it's going to happen. We're going to have to wait. The final question, RIA Novosti. During a short conversation with Netanyahu, did you discuss a possibility of a meeting in the upcoming future? No, we haven't planned anything so far, but we have discussed the tragedy that happened. I'm talking about the downing of a Russian plane. Of course, we know the position of Israel. They believe that they have nothing to do with the tragedy. We also discussed a number of other issues related to our bilateral cooperation in the region and in Syria on the whole. As for any specific schedules for our upcoming meeting, bilateral meeting, this wasn't something we discussed, no.
Interfax.
Mr. President, do you believe that, taking into account the volatility of the current petrochemical market, is there any reason to cooperate with Saudi Arabia and limit the production of oil? No, I'm not going to say anything about limiting the production of oil, because every word here is has a very high weight. But the fact that we need to cooperate with Saudi Arabia is self-evident. We are going to cooperate with Saudi Arabia. OPEC has been very positive. We have a lot of positive results with OPEC, and according to Russian experts, the changes, the volatility we see today is temporary. The price is very unstable, but it can actually start rising again. As you know, we have discussed this thing as well with Mr. Trump in Paris over the past 18 months. America has also increased the production of oil and gas, and it means that they are importing less and less oil and gas. This changes the global hydrocarbon market as well. A lot depends on the price. Right now the price has decreased a little, and that is why there are changes in the market. All of it is related. We need to have an optimal price both for producers and for consumers of petrochemicals and oil products and gas. The previous price was something we believed was quite good. Right now, our budget is created taking into account that oil price will be $40 per barrel. But we are going to have, in the upcoming year, this year, we're going to have a budget surplus. I think last year, I believe we had $120 billion surplus with a very low debt, which is a great basis for continuing our work in a very stable and consistent manner, and achieving better results in terms of GDP growth and structural changes in the economy. That is all. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Brexit and high drama. The saga continues. Also, the CIA says it has high confidence they know who killed Khashoggi. And is it high noon for Julian Assange? Cross-talking some real news, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And we have Glenn Deason. He is a professor at the Higher School of Economics, as well as author of The Decay of Western Civilization and Resurgence of Russia. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's first go to Brexit. Everything is in flux right now. We have a number of resignations. We have the Tory party that seems to be in chaos. We will know more as the week progresses here. But Mark, it seems to me, and you know, I'm
I didn't read all 500 plus pages here, but what I did glean from it is that it appears May's plan is not it's either still in, but not completely out of the European Union. This is not what the people voted for. What was your read?
Without reading the full 500 pages either myself, do you draw your conclusions from the fact that her own Brexit secretary has resigned? I mean, this is her team is falling apart. Her team is in revolt. Her party is in revolt. The other party, Labour, doesn't seem involved at all under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. They're perfectly willing to see May's government go down in flames at this point, and I don't blame them.
But at the same time, she's sticking to her guns. We'll see how this story develops right here. But it's not, I mean, I think the most important point here is that this is not what the electorate voted for. It is appears to be a halfway measure. May has actually indicated that in her defense of her plan to leave the European Union.
Yeah, and this is almost 2 years of negotiations, and Theresa May has always been quite explicit that Brexit means Brexit, and that entails leaving the customs union.
But the plan doesn't.
No. The way it stands now, they might stay in the customs union in perpetuity. And the second is no EU jurisdictions over Britain, and that has also been accepted that they will have. So the two main aspects, which she has essentially been saying that these are two red lines, both of them she has given in. So it's quite an extraordinary position, and I don't think that it's unfair to say that this would make almost Britain a colony of the EU. And you have to see the unity she's been able to bring, though, because now the Brexiteers, the ones who wanted to leave Britain, they're essentially saying it would be better to stay in the EU than this deal. And the people who wanted to remain, they're essentially saying now, well, many of them saying we would be willing to crash out of the EU without any deal than this, because this is the worst of all worlds, and essentially everyone is coming against her, and that is...
It's a halfway measure here.
Ironically enough, it's like a new colony without representation.
Exactly. I mean, because basically, I mean, I know that on like immigration, everyone, it's very clear in this document here. But Dima, it seems that they will still be in a customs union with the European Union without any say whatsoever. Being in the European Union, they have leverage. Now, the most important element, the economy, they're giving away to Brussels.
Well, it sounds like a lot of taxation without representation. But the question is, did the British or any other citizens of any EU country, did they have any say in the first place? I mean, the EU made it very clear that they will make it as painful for Britain as possible, so that they will teach a lesson to the others. Don't leave the union, it's going to be costly.
That's obvious.
But in the end, it's going to backfire, because the EU already looks like a kolkhoz, which is permanently at war in Libya, at war in Yugoslavia, at war in other places. And now people will find out that once you're in that kolkhoz, there's no way you can get out.
Where does democracy stand in all of this? Because I keep going back to the vote. This is what the electorate wanted. Mark, is it because people are going to be questioning this? I mean, what's the point of voting if the ruling class doesn't follow through?
A part of it, of course, is the problem that when people voted, they weren't. There was no deal for them to vote on. It was clear. David Cameron never intended to call the vote for it to succeed. So the Tory party had no plan for Brexit because they didn't want it. And it was the insurgents, the backbenchers, right? And you know, the Eurosceptics like Farage who led the voice of the people on this. But there has never been a plan put forward. People voted for Brexit, but... There was no details of what that meant. Of course, now that is going to now be used as a excuse, I believe, for annulling Brexit to begin with, because
was this May's plan all along?
I think this is doom. This is there might be a degree of intentionality here to have the whole mess go down in flames so badly that then there's an excuse to shift a second vote to Parliament or a second referendum.
I don't know if it would be 50% of the electorate, right. But it would be a good chunk of the electorate would find that to be a betrayal.
Yeah, and I think that Well, there's only two ways to explain how such a horrible deal could come. I mean, either they're incompetent, or second, it would be that they wanted us.
I think you can stop partner. There.
Yes. No, but at the second one, it has to be kept in mind, not only David Cameron didn't want Brexit, like Theresa May was running on remaining in the EU, and they made her essentially in charge of bringing the UK out of the EU. So there's been a lot of secrecy during these negotiations, and suddenly at the end, once she put forward this deal, she made the threat essentially saying, listen, if this doesn't go through, there might not be a Brexit at all. So this is quite astonishing after saying for 2 years Brexit means Brexit. And
but see, what's going on right now is that on the 25th of November, there's some kind of signing ceremony where this is going to happen with the EU. But it seems, Fatima, that the plan isn't complete yet, okay? I mean, this will be very interesting to see what is signed, if it's signed at all. Mm. Then the public will be told what the British Prime Minister actually signed up to?
Well, unelected British Prime Minister. There is a deadline. Theresa May promised that by, I guess, March the 29th...
That's the date of
department. You know, the UK will be out of the EU, but I'm not sure about that anymore.
Yeah, but they might be... I mean, Theresa May, Brexit means Brexit, but does Brexit mean Brexit? Yeah, they'll be out of the EU, but will they be out of the EU?
Look, now Brexit is becoming a kind of a scourge, you know. It's a weak that the euro officials show to the nations which are not compliant. Donald Tusk, the former ultra-liberal Polish prime minister, who is now the chairman of the European Union, he recently said in an interview to a Polish newspaper, to the Polish media, Poland may fall out of the EU, just like the UK inadvertently fell out. And it's going to be a disaster. And you can see his strategy. He wants to go back to Polish politics and be elected the president. So his message is, if you don't want any trouble, if you don't want the same losses that the UK is going through, vote for me because I am the only outcome that will not cost
but
you
billions. But is this a form of...
It's basically, it's blackmail.
No, it's fear-mongering. It's fear-mongering.
Peter, it's clear that Brexit means Brexit, but what does Brexit mean? And what does means mean? I mean, this is the absurdity we're in here right now. I agree. This is a measure of incompetence, but I also agree that there is a measure of intentionality, and we could call it incompetent intentionality behind all this.
Well, what about this? Because this is my gut feeling here, is that Theresa May is going to keep the Tories together even after these resignations because behind closed doors they're saying, do you want Jeremy to be the next prime minister? This is the leverage she has right now, okay? Because the many people, particularly the deep state, because of Jeremy's foreign policy attitudes, they do not want to see him as prime minister.
Peter, if I could just jump in there, I wanted to say that you have to consider this perfect storm with Brexit could only happen while Jeremy Corbyn is leading the Labour Party. This is why New Labour and the UK elite, the media, even the supposedly left-wing Guardian have been so desperate to overthrow him, because he regards the people's vote on Brexit as the democracy, the people have spoken. Any other Labour leader, any New Labour leader, would have provided a revolt against the referendum, shifted the vote. The parliament called for a second referendum, but they can't do that with Jeremy Corbyn because he's the threat on the other side. If May's government falls, there's the threat, the threat of all threats, the specter haunting Europe that is Corbyn would be elected. And that's a perfect storm.
I think, unfortunately, the British elite doesn't have plan B for Jeremy Corbyn becoming the prime minister, just like didn't have plan B for Donald Trump. He was not supposed to win. And the people who vote for this referendum, you know, if Tony Blair was in charge of the Labour Party, they would have thrown it out, saying that a basket of deplorables voted. So what? You know, that was the message from the American elite to the American people after American people elected Trump. You are a basket of deplorables. Are we going to listen to what you want to say? No, we're not going to listen to it.
Left-wing deplorables.
Exactly.
I think at the end, what might happen is, because now they're going to have this, essentially be in the EU, except they won't have any voting rights. So I think if this...
Well, that's like being a little bit pregnant, yes. Okay? I mean, come on, it doesn't make any sense.
No,
okay?
But I think that's, if that's what happens, I think there will be a strong incentive to essentially put it to British people. Listen, do you want to... At least this is what Brexit means. It means everything's the same except we don't have a say. Or do you want to join the EU?
Just a typical EU strategy. Yeah. Just have as many elections as you need to get your result. This is the game they play all the time.
This is the EU format, yes.
Yes.
Every referendum and vote that doesn't go their way in the EU, you have to do it over again. Of course, this is a British decision, but the elites are kind of close on this.
I mean, that system of voting until you get the right answer. I believe they call that democracy in the EU.
If that goes back to my original question. What is the state of democracy? Finish up.
Yeah, if you remember the vote or referendums on the constitution for Europe, the British, the French and the Dutch, they voted no. So essentially... And the Irish, and they relabeled it as being... the Lisbon Treaty, and then they didn't need to have the vote anymore, so they just pushed it through, except the Irish who did.
All right, hold that thought. We're going to go to a break here. After that break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's switch gears here. Mark, differences of opinion and analysis in the U.S. Regarding the Khashoggi affair. The CIA has come out with a statement, high confidence, that it goes all the way to the top in Saudi Arabia. Donald Trump can kind of living in denial. I think that's a good way of looking at it here. And then we have, I don't know if you gentlemen saw it. I saw it a few hours ago. Someone placed on Facebook a video of someone being hacked to death. Don't know if it was authentic. It was authentic enough that I thought it was a real person being hacked to death, and then Facebook took it down. The only reason why I mention this is because only Erdogan would allow that to be released to the media if, in fact, what I saw was authentic. I'm not saying it was because I don't know. But a lot of things in play here, Mark.
Well, I mean, Saudi Arabia is a terror-spawning, murderous, absolute monarchy. But as Donald Trump said, they are our very good ally. They're very good for our economy. Lots of jobs, right?
That empirically isn't true. I'm glad that you mentioned that, Mark. And I want to get a shout out here for the American conservative, Rand Paul, who's been talking about Saudi Arabia. A fascinating article here. Saudi Arabia is number one at spreading terror. I suggest everyone take a look at that article.
Is terror not good for jobs?
It's good for some people.
The military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm.
Glenn, now you have the State Department is definitive as the CIA is here, and then the President Trump is still vacillating here right now. There are a number of sanctions being imposed here, but this is turning into more than an embarrassment here.
Yeah, and it seems that everyone in the United States aren't exactly on the same page either. Who would have known? But if the CIA is now
understatement, yeah. that's his nickname. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's his nickname. Yeah,
but that's if the CIA is saying, "Yeah, we know that MBS knew about this, and if not even ordered it." And if you compare that to what the president say or trying to make excuses for Saudi Arabia, I think they're getting very different signals. And again, Rand Paul is. He stands out usually, though. He's probably the most principled person they have over there. He sticks by his principles, but he's saying that Saudi Arabia is not it is the greatest sponsor of terror, not Iran, which is usually positioned that way.
I'm glad you brought up Iran here, because I think this is what it's all about. We could do a separate program on the political changes going on in Israel, on Netanyahu's government. I think now he's prime minister, acting foreign minister, and acting defense minister. So he's got a lot on his plate right here. Mm. And then we have the situation with Saudi Arabia. I think the reason why Trump is continuing to support the crown prince is because he has some grand strategy. Ask Mike Pompeo, and it's all about Iran. And the two key players that this plan is predicated on is Israel and Saudi Arabia. And both of them are not in the best of shape right now. Dima.
Well, I mean, the story with Syria is repeating itself.
Good point.
By the European media and by the American media that Assad was just so murderous. You know, he kills his own people. But when terrorist acts started to be committed in Europe, they never even remotely suspected Assad. For some reason, they suspected the people who were opposed to Assad. They suspected the Islamic State, other Islamist organizations supported by the West in Syria. Now the same story. We've heard about Iran being the chief sponsor of international terrorism.
Oh, that's a cliche. It's
so long. And there was not a single case. But here we have Saudi Arabia, which is an ally, which is, of course, not a sponsor of terrorism. And then they kill Khashoggi, and then they kill lots of people in Yemen, and then they kill basically 15 out of 19 terrorists who did the 9/11 terrorist acts. 15 out of 19 were from Saudi Arabia. And how can you explain all of this? You know, the official story...
You know what I can explain, Dima? Money! Lots of money
exactly.
being pumped in
and
to
also,
prop up the PR image of the of Riyadh.
And the official story that we have from Saudi Arabia, you know, the chief prosecutor said that he indicted 11 people on Khashoggi's murder and demanded death penalty for
But the crown
them.
Prince was... he was head of the new committee to investigate this
himself.
Murder.
Himself.
Believe me, if he didn't demand death penalty for five of them, he could be the one.
Mark, what's the dynamic? You've mentioned it before on this program. The CIA would like to see someone else.
Exactly. See, this is the story here. I mean, I'm sure it comes as no shock to any of our viewers, at least, that Saudi Arabia is a murderous, thuggish, Wahhabist theocracy, right? That kills its own people. I mean, the fact that anyone is surprised by this is a testament to the media and Washington's
hypocrisy,
moral bankruptcy. But the real story is here is why did the CIA link this in obvious contradiction to exactly what the White House is saying, right? Because the CIA obviously has very important interests with Saudi Arabia. I mean, by their own words, they called Mohammed bin Salman in the same announcement that he was responsible for this, said, but he's a good technocrat. Okay. He's volatile and arrogant.
Mark, I think we can agree that you can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig.
He goes from 0 to 60, and he doesn't seem to understand that there's things you
what
can't
kind
do.
What kind of language
I mean,
is that?
This
0
is coming,
to 60?
This language, talking about he doesn't seem to understand there's things you can't do, it's coming from the organization that under Obama was given an assassination czar and is responsible for the extrajudicial, extraterritorial assassination of thousands around the world by their flying murder machines. This is insane. I believe that they're trying to make a play, despite their contrastations to the contrary, that his ascension as king is still taken for granted, that they want Mohammed bin Nayef, who has long
been
their man.
So, what it is, it keeps Trump in a bind here.
It also targets Trump.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, I want to switch gears to another important story here. The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald, again hits the ball out of the park here on the Julian Assange here, story. As the Obama DOJ concluded, prosecution of Julian Assange for publishing documents poses grave threats to press freedom. Glenn, that's absolutely correct. The Obama administration pulled back on indicting. Well, by the way, there is reports that a sealed indictment has been made against Julian Assange. That's widely reported, but we don't have much more evidence than that. But what is absolutely true is that if the Obama administration had gone through with the prosecution of Julian Assange, they would have to prosecute the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. I could go on and on. Now they're finding a different way around it. And I think it has a lot to do with Russiagate as well, because this is what I presume they're going to go after Assange it's his involvement, alleged involvement in leaking the emails, John Podesta's emails, and more things. I think that's one of the reasons why I want to do this. It makes the Republicans and the Democrats happy at the same time.
Yes, and that's what makes it quite extraordinary, because if you look back at the Bush presidency, Assange became a little bit of a darling for the Democrats because he exposed a lot of the crimes of of Bush's invasion of Iraq or the conduct there. And I think that, not the darling, but let's say, just say they, like Trump said,
I love WikiLeaks for the same reason during the campaign.
But then WikiLeaks, they essentially exposed that Clinton and the DNC was rigging the primary. And then because of this, that's pretty much why she lost the election. And now they blame Assange for Hillary not being president. So now essentially the Democrats turn on him as well, which is interesting because we see all this high talk about protecting journalism. This is, it seems to be very skin deep only because at the end of the day, if it doesn't serve their interests, they're ready to throw the journalists under the bus.
They're far more concerned about the fate of crybaby Jim Acosta than they are regarding Julian Assange. Go figure, huh?
Trump said that Assange and Edward Snowden deserved death penalty. And that is not, going against the freedom of journalism. That is not, death penalty for these people is nothing. Jim Acosta, poor Jim Acosta, thrown out of the White House for not allowing anyone to ask a question. That is a crime against the freedom of the press, right? And the point with Assange is that every time he says something, in the end he cracks up to be right. He has been saying that there was this sealed indictment against him. He has been saying it for years. Yeah. And for years, the United States and the UK denied it. And now we see accidentally that it was true. And it popped up accidentally.
Mark, I guess it was a few months ago, it was in this calendar year, Hollywood came out with their film, The Post, and celebrating the Washington Post when it came to the Pentagon Papers in 1971. You had Daniel Ellsberg, he was the enemy of the Nixon administration. But the Post and other journalists, they stood up for freedom of the press and for freedom of expression. Mm-hmm. Uniformly, that's not the case today. That's a tragedy of journalism today.
We saw a big turn, not just with the media, and it is the mainstream media, but with the Democratic Party.
Yep,
as
flipping.
Well, right? And Glenn pointed this out very well. Flipping on this, they supported it when it was against the Bush administration. And then the question is, what happened? Why have they sided with some of the most extreme elements of the Trump administration and so on? And Glenn points this out very well.
Which Glenn?
Glenn Greenwald. Okay, Glenn Greenwald in the article we're talking. But, the other Glenn. But the grand irony is that many Democrats will side with the Trump DOJ over the Obama DOJ. Their emotional, personal contempt for Assange due to the fact that he helped defeat Hillary, belief that he helped defeat Hillary Clinton. The gravest crime easily outweighs any concerns about the threat posed to press freedoms by the Trump admin's attempt to criminalize and the publication of documents. It's sheerly venal, ignoble, partisan politics. I'm old enough to remember when the press was talking about a Bush war against the media. I'm old enough to remember when the press was talking about Obama's war against the media, his war against whistleblowers, pursuing more sources than all the governments in previous U.S. history put together. When he had, his administration had journalists at the New York Times put in jail for not revealing their sources.
So what you're saying, we've run out of time, gentlemen, but what you're saying, Mark, is that left to right, it doesn't really matter. They have a contempt for freedom of speech here and journalism here. That's all the time we have here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.